This is a Relay Project.
Seriously starts now. Here's Supriya and Ryan.
Hey, hey, it's Wednesday, October 12th, and you're listening to Seriously with Supriya and Ryan. I am Supriya Devetti in Toronto.
I'm Ryan Jesperson in Edmonton. It's great to see your face again after a week away.
Yeah, you too. And you've got that new premiere glow, shall I say. Looking good. New studios, new premiere.
New studio, new premiere. It's a new era in Edmonton, Alberta. But seriously, Alberta's premier, Danielle Smith, that's going to take some getting used to in saying that, making an early impression, not just with Albertans, but across the country, I think. We'll get to that a little bit later on in today's show.
Yeah, I think we will. Also, just quite
that
a
sounded
lot
like
happened.
A question. I think we probably should.
Yeah, let's save some of that for when we actually get into it a little bit later.
Sure.
Lots of news coming out of Ottawa. The list for the public hearings looking into the use of the Emergencies Act came out in terms of who you're going to call upon to testify. A lot of senior public servants, a lot of ministers. The prime minister is on there as well. Interestingly enough, though, no Doug Ford, premier of Ontario. Ottawa is in Ontario, so it's a little bit odd that the premier wouldn't be called, but you know, it is what it is.
Does that just continue to work out for him? He kind of stayed out of the whole thing from the very beginning. It seems to be continuing to pay off again and again and again.
Yeah, he's like the kid who just, you know, in a group project doesn't really do much and then manages somehow to get the same grade as everybody else. And while everyone else is getting chastised by the teacher for maybe not putting in the work, he manages to skate by. I mean, it's a strategy and it works for him. So like, why not continue doing it, right?
I feel like that sort of scenario resonated with you deeply. Is there some personal experience? You don't strike me as the type of student that just coasted along and cashed in on the group's hard work. You were the one doing all the hard work.
Yeah, I mean, I coasted every now and again, but you know, if we want to peel back some of the layers into my tiger parenting and my childhood, I think it's safe to assume I was the one putting in the hard work. Yeah.
Okay, good. See, this is why we're so great. We're the yin and the yang. Because if you need the perspective represented of the jerk that rolled in and sort of, you know, tried to add some last minute pillow fluffing to the group, that was always my skill set. And I was always grateful for the contributions of my lab partners and classmates over the years.
But you did, you know, sometimes you need that showmanship and you need the pillow fluffing. So it's all good.
You know, every group needs different elements and and we all bring something different to the table, don't we?
Yeah, we do. Let's talk about this and how you feel about this being an Albertan. But the Parti Québécois leader is refusing to take an oath to the crown. Like everybody who gets sworn into the National Assembly has to swear, you know, they take a pledge or an oath. And part of it is to pledge their, you know, loyalty to the crown, and he's refusing to do so. I mean, I certainly get it, and you and I have talked a little bit about the monarchy and the fact that I'm a small R Republican, you know, in this respect. But I'm wondering if that rubs folks in the rest of Canada the wrong way.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't rub me the wrong way. I mean, quite frankly, I don't care, and I would think that the majority of people don't. I would think that politically, it probably plays pretty well. And I would suspect that if you actually got, you know, the average Canadian to consider it, to spend a couple minutes thinking about it, or 10 seconds even, that the average person, their view might actually align. I don't know that, you know, we have these institutions and these offices and this structure in place, and it's always worked. And, you know, the average person probably doesn't spend too much time disseminating it, but I don't think that anyone, I mean, you know, you may find a few people that are like offended about it, because people are offended about everything. Yeah. And I'm sure that there would be some people that may sort of cry out in horror, but I'm not sure that the average Canadian either in or outside of Quebec would spend more than 10 seconds thinking about this. What do you think?
Yeah, I'd have to agree with that. Also, like, I mean, story kind of checks out, right? Like, the Parti Québécois leader doesn't really want to pledge a loyalty oath. Like, I don't know. And, like, Quebecers, I think, generally tend to show more indifference towards the monarchy than, I think, the rest of Canada generally. But I don't know. It's silly that there isn't, like, an alternative just for that sort of oath. I mean, different provinces do allow for an alternative, is in my understanding. And so it's just it's a little bit odd that Quebec wouldn't have already come up with something that was, you know, a viable option for them.
But. Yeah. Hey, before we really sink our teeth into the top stories of the week, the ones that are really catching our attention as well, I was curious to pick your brain a little bit on POTUS and pot pardons. There's been a lot of talk, probably not enough in Canada, about wiping records, and there are actually, I mean, racial and otherwise, there are a ton of big storylines and reasons why we should spend more time talking about the history of cannabis and cannabis legislation and convictions, and in some cases in the United States, like life sentences related to this. This is actually kind of a big deal.
It is, and it's a huge shift, right? I would say in the U.S., particularly at the federal level, at least just within the last few years of going through with a blanket sort of pot pardon. And I think it's welcome news. I think Canada could have certainly stepped it up when we were going through the legalization process and ensuring that folks, especially, you know, Black, Brown, and Indigenous folks in this country who have been hit much harder with cannabis legislation and the criminalization of it, were to see their records wiped effectively. And we didn't really see that here. So, and there were a lot of very substantive criticisms that were leveled at the federal government at the time. And my understanding is it has gotten a touch better, but there's still certainly a ton of room for improvement on that front.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to look too far in Canada or elsewhere to find somebody whose life has been, you know, all but destroyed based on a conviction around cannabis possession. And we're not talking about the people that are bringing in, you know, pallets. We're not talking about the people that are importing tons of cannabis. We're talking about, in some circumstances, people that were busted 25 years ago with a joint in their pocket. Yeah. Typically, you know, members of minority communities, generally speaking, and it's something that certainly deserves more of a conversation and probably more of the public's attention. Speaking of ongoing stories, Sapri, it's safe to say that it doesn't matter which province you're talking about, healthcare continues to be an issue, and that includes staffing shortages. And this opens up, of course, an interesting question as well, and that is, what do you do when the system, the healthcare system, is woefully understaffed and you desperately need to hire people? You know, sometimes a situation like this can lead to rush hiring where you don't train or verify credentials as well as you should.
Yeah, and that's a horrible and terrible thing to do, because it could lead to situations like the one we saw in British Columbia just last year, where there was a nurse that was working with forged credentials. So when you're understaffed, verifying those credentials and providing that best-in-class training is actually even more important. And if you need help with training in a regulated industry, you need to know about We Know Training. We Know Training is not just your standard LMS platform. They specialize in high-stakes training for associations, regulators, governments, and credentialing bodies with the highest degree of quality and trust. And just to give you some examples, they work with credentialing partners like Hunter Educators and licensing organizations, medical associations, liquor and cannabis retail worker training for provincial regulators, accredited training for licensed professions like real estate, insurance, as well as the financial planning industry, and many more highly regulated industry where that high quality training really matters.
Yeah, you know, we've seen a lot of news stories in past where people in these incredibly important industries have suffered from online training that just isn't designed or delivered in the most trustworthy way. We Know Training can help you reach a larger audience, monetize your training program, create impactful courses hassle-free, that's big, and deliver top-tier training to generate reoccurring revenue. As a fully managed solution partner, We Know Training handles every step along the way. They make online learning engaging, fun, plus your learners will actually retain and apply the information in the real world. Imagine that. So if you're looking for a partner who will provide high-stakes training without the stress, look up We Know Training. You can find more on their website at wenotraining.ca.
the lead.
I welcome the news of the CEO's resignation and also Scott Smith resignation. So starting today, we're going to work with the organization to rebuild it and to make sure that the new leadership is going to have the same motivation that we have to implement culture change and fight sexual violence in the organization.
So the voice you just heard there was Federal Minister Pascal Saint-Onge, Minister of Sport, you know, reacting to the news of basically after months of digging in their heels and refusing to even acknowledge there was a problem, let alone the severity of the toxic misogynist culture at Hockey Canada. The organization will have entirely new leadership, president, CEO, entire board out. And this comes just after a little over a week ago, I think it was last Tuesday, so almost exactly a week ago, where you had their interim board chair basically lashing out and saying that all of the attention that the organization is getting is because of the media and because of misinformation, and they shouldn't be a scapegoat for larger societal problems. And I guess it didn't go over too well internally because now everyone's out.
And that's not to say that there aren't larger societal issues at play, right? That's not to say that, sure, that there aren't large societal issues that need to be addressed. But Hockey Canada, in my mind, to state the very obvious, misread the room, mm-hmm, in one of the most gross misunderstandings, a misunderstanding of such great magnitude that you have to wonder what the conversations looked like around that boardroom table as they were preparing. Like, Supriya, like you said, there was a lot of runway. There was a lot of time for one of the more prominent brands in Canada. And when you're talking Hockey Canada as well, I mean, let me sort of go off on a tangent for just a quick second. And many journalists and in my mind more like columnists have made great points on this, is that this is so much more than just an involvement or a brand or a national entity. This is Hockey Canada, that brand. Everyone, as they're hearing us talking, they're thinking of that logo. And to many people, that logo is on the travel mug that people hold in their hand as they fill it, they lean against their kitchen counter bleary eyed at 5:40 in the morning. Yeah. And the SUV or the minivan is running in the driveway to warm up because it's -24 and they have an ice time, 40 minutes away in the neighboring town. And so this is like a commitment. I hesitate to invoke the word religion, but it is, for thousands and thousands, maybe even millions of people, if you draw on people's history and their own personal experience over the years. And so this is something that people take so very seriously. And so when you feel as a Canadian or as a hockey parent or as a hockey player or as somebody that's associated in some way with Hockey Canada, when you feel that betrayal, it hits so very deeply, in a way that I don't think many brands or many national entities other than Hockey Canada would. And I know that I'm not the only one that was left with my jaw hitting the floor as I heard some of those comments last week. I mean, it was unimaginable. You have to wonder. I mean, the resignation of the entire board, the CEO stepping down, it's like, well, duh.
Yeah. Yeah, it is well duh. And the reason why it's well duh to someone like you or I is because, to your point, it was very obvious that they had misread the room and that they were acting with chutzpah, hubris, however you want to qualify it, but that they just weren't up to owning up to anything about this. And, we can talk about the intersection of rape culture and toxic masculinity sort of intertwining to produce the outcomes that we saw with Hockey Canada. But I think even just going a little bit wider in terms of that lens, the main issue that I think we saw with that organization just generally is the fact that all of those leaders thought that they were dealing with only a comms issue or only a PR issue. And so they were managing it as though it was a comms or PR issue and not one of an actual crisis in culture, right? If you have a culture that is rife with misogyny or rife with other toxic behaviors, like hazing is another huge issue, right? You're not going to be able to change that culture if all of the people who allowed that culture to go on are still involved in the organization and are only trying to win the next news cycle battle. Mm-hmm. Like, this goes so much more beyond that. And you invoking religion, I know you were hesitant to do so, but I actually think it's quite fitting here, because I think Hockey Canada, for their part, assumed that because they hold such a high place and such an intimate place to a degree with a lot of Canadians, that they were untouchable. And that was simply not the case. And we saw basically an entire summer unfold with committee hearings at the Standing Committee of Canadian Heritage, where like MPs were just, I don't know, like almost baffled at how bad some of their answers were and the deflections that they heard from the leadership at Hockey Canada.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, there's the story, and I'm going to come across in a way that, you know, if you're the same as me, Supriya, sometimes when you are a little bit baffled or when you are frustrated about something, you can come across as a little bit dismissive because you don't really know how to process it, and that's in a way where I'm at with this story. You know, you hear of like the slush funds, the contingency funds, I think they called one of them the National Equity Fund, and these were multi-million dollar accounts that were used literally to settle sexual assault claims. And one of the things that I think is lost in all of this, maybe not at the kitchen table level, but at least in the national discussion, is that, you know, people are acting, you know, people will say like there's, you know, and credit to the amazing investigative journalists that have uncovered this. This is certainly not a slight against them at all. We wouldn't be talking about this without their digging, but people will say, you know, we've recognized or we've revealed that there's a second contingency fund to settle sexual assault claims. And everybody goes, oh, there's a second contingency fund. Oh, and everyone's up in arms about the contingency funds. Nobody's talking about, like, hang on a second. There are multiple sexual assault claims. Like, wait a second. Like, this is so much of an issue that we've had to establish specific funds that we can continue to draw upon to settle multiple sustained sexual assault claims. Like, that demands more attention. And I don't think that it's getting that proper attention right now, maybe because the majority of us aren't comfortable talking about it, because this hits really close to home for a lot of people.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And if anyone has read some of the allegations in that 2018 group sexual assault that happened in London, Ontario, they are horrific. And again, just to remind folks, Hockey Canada ended up basically burying the facts of that case. We don't know a lot. The police in London are reopening their investigation, very much thanks to the investigative reporting that, you know, you pointed out, Ryan, and a big shout out to Robin Doolittle in particular at the Globe and Mail for this, and her, you know, more dogged reporting just generally when it comes to sexual assault. And it's I think, you know, them stepping down is the easy part. Now it's like the actual hard work begins, where you not only have to get good people into those roles, but you have to ensure that they're also up for the challenge of changing that entire culture. And I don't know, you know, how you can do that without it taking a bit of time, because it is going to take time to ensure that you got the right people and that they're going to be up for the work. And, you know, I know that there are all sorts of folks that are quite hopeful about the fact that, you know, you're going to have this independent report and there's all these recommendations. But, you know, if independent reports by themselves, by retired Supreme Court justices, solved all our problems, then we wouldn't have any problems in the Canadian Armed Forces, right? Because we've had so many reports pointing to how it can be made better. So you do need the culture itself to change. And I, you know, that's not going to be easy.
Yeah, I think that there was it was a reality check, not in a good way. But when former interim board chair Andrea Skinner essentially said, like if, you know, and I'm paraphrasing, but like if Hockey Canada, if the board steps away or if Hockey Canada folds, like, we don't know if the lights are going to stay on at the rink.
Yeah.
We don't know. And that to me, I mean, that it was almost like, and this is going to be an unfair comment. Every once in a while, we'll throw an unfair comment out there. But, you know, for hockey parents, it's like the reports of these horrific allegations around several different World Juniors teams. And I suspect, and I hate to say it, I suspect that that's just the tip of the iceberg, Sapria.
Yep.
I think that there's probably more stories out there. I mean, we're not even talking about Ian Cole with the Tampa Bay Lightning suspended after Twitter allegations or allegations posted on Twitter around an alleged sexual assault involving a minor several years ago when he was already playing in the National Hockey League, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's story after story after story. And that's I'm not suggesting that didn't resonate with people. I'm not suggesting that didn't trouble hockey parents. But what really lit a fire under hockey parents was when Andrea Skinner said, "We don't know without us if the lights are going to stay on in the rink." And that's when we saw a ton of people, I don't want to call them nobodies, but not known people, just your average John and Jill Q public step up and say, "Oh, the lights will stay on at the rink. Don't you worry about us." I think that one of the things that has to happen in a circumstance like this is that change starts with motivated people, people operating under conviction at the grassroots level. And I think that that is happening right now, because if you're a mom or a dad of a young hockey player, you cannot and will not stand for what you've learned about how Hockey Canada has conducted itself and the pass that hockey players have been given, star hockey players have been given over the years.
So let me just ask you one really quick question, because I know we got to move on, but like, do you think this finally means we can start talking about rape culture and toxic masculinity are bad for society? Or is this still just woke liberal BS that we're never going to be able to properly address and talk about?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that when people hear phrases like toxic masculinity, some people will write it off as woke liberal BS. But I dare anybody to try to suggest that there's not very real problems right now with Canada's favorite game.
Also, there's this.
So, Sapria, everybody's talking about these hashtags that Pierre Poilievre's staffers were using for his YouTube videos going back years in some circumstances. It's a story that I think, though, with regards to the general public, might be flying under the radar. What's this MGTOW? Can you bring us up to speed?
Yeah, so I mean, you basically said the story right there, but they're not really hashtags on his YouTube videos. They're not tags that the viewers can actually openly see. They're only inputted by the publisher. They are hidden from plain view. You can see what the tags are once you go into the video page's source code. Pierre Poilievre, for his part, has claimed that he, was unaware of it. They have taken the tags down. They've been in use since March of 2018. MGTOW, for folks that don't know, refers to men going their own way. It's part of the larger manosphere that exists on the internet. And I think in its most charitable interpretation, MGTOW can basically be described as a group of heterosexual men that have, trying to opt out of any sort of female relationship
like
or
incel?
Companionship. Well, it's not. Yeah, it's incel adjacent, I would say. And it's worth noting that MGTOW as a tag or as a subreddit have been, so Reddit banned the r/MGTOW subreddit, and it was explained by by them that it's because it was well known for radicalizing men to hate women and even engage in extreme violence, and that's a quote. TikTok has also gotten rid of the MGTOW tag, and so, you know, I get that this is flying under the radar for a lot of folks, but it's we're talking about it in the wrong way. And the reason why I say that is because we're focused on the actual tag itself, and we're focused on whether or not, what Poilievre knew and when he knew it, and, whether he now denounces this. But the actual meat of this is more interesting, because the federal government is going to introduce online harms legislation at some point, either later this year or very early into 2023. And when we're talking about online harms legislation, we're really talking about the algorithms that a lot of these big tech platforms and social media platforms use. So the question becomes, what and how does YouTube's algorithm work when it comes to algorithmically amplified content into your feed. And as you're sitting there, as somebody, you know, at your computer watching a YouTube video, what comes up next as your recommended video and how YouTube factors that in terms of all of the data that they have on you and your interests and what they assume you like, is way more interesting of a conversation, in my opinion, than whether or not the MGTOW tag was known to be used by the staffers and which staffer it was that put it in there.
Yeah, like, can we all agree that Pierre Poilievre, there's a very good chance he did not know. I don't think that he's hovering over the YouTube posts to make sure that his junior staffer is using certain tags. I don't think that that's the story here, like you've said. What matters here is the bigger picture understanding of if we were to lift the hood on these platforms and not just YouTube exclusively, what would the implications be? It's not necessarily even about Pierre Poilievre at all, except the fact that at least one of his staffers saw an alignment with their target audience, with that tag or that community and who they're trying to reach. And maybe that's an entirely different conversation. But say, for example, parents of a tween that might be watching skateboard videos and all of a sudden have the next video pop up on YouTube be something that's a little less desirable from a parenting perspective, right? Here's where the conversation really needs to go.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, we're not the only ones that are going about it this way. Like, the EU has a similar approach where you're looking at the actual systems themselves, and they're demanding way more transparency from the platforms in terms of their algorithms, in terms of the data that they're collecting. UK as well has a developed an approach that is similar to that. And by the way, they have a conservative government who put this forward. So the fact that we're talking about online harms as like state censorship or censoring of the internet is quite frankly bullshit. And I think we need to move beyond that into just demanding more transparency and accountability from these billion-dollar companies that are warping large segments of the way people perceive reality. And it's we need that. And I don't know how we can safeguard our democracy without demanding that transparency and accountability, because we're already see the effects of it being, you know, chipped away at. And the fact that we do have so many people that don't experience reality or don't perceive reality in the same way that a lot of other people do. And there's a very, very big problem when folks can't agree on what is and isn't true.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the general public asks in earnest, and I'm about to take a bit of a leap here, but I think it's a fair one. The public asks in earnest, for example, how do young people become radicalized? If we actually care about the real answer to an important question like that, these are the types of things we need to pay more attention to.
Seriously?
So they have been the most discriminated against group that I've ever witnessed in my lifetime. That's a pretty extreme level of discrimination that we have seen. I don't take away any of the discrimination that I've seen in those other groups that you mentioned, but this has been an extraordinary time in the last year in particular. And I want people to know that I find that unacceptable, that we are not going to create a segregated society.
So I just want to be really clear here for folks that we tried our best not to use another Danielle Smith clip. And then this was popping up all over our feeds yesterday, and we couldn't not talk about this.
We said we weren't going to. We promised you we were going to talk about Kanye West.
Yeah, we were.
But
here we are.
You can't ignore
this one. Claiming the unvaccinated are the most discriminated against group that she's seen in her lifetime.
Yeah. There's about 6 million people from the 1940s that would like to have a word with the Danielle Smith office. I actually, you know what? I don't even want to joke about it. It's like, it's a statement. I talked to somebody just hours after Alberta's newest premier made that comment, an ardent and strident conservative, Supriya. And they said to me, she was doing so well on her first day. She was doing so well.
She was.
And then that, I sat down with her exclusively just hours before she made the comment. People can check it out in the Real Talk archives. And judge for yourself. She made and is making vaccines and vaccination status a huge part of her public messaging early in her tenure. And I mean,
she's the only openly anti-vax premier we have.
Yeah,
no?
She is vaccinated, but
yeah,
you're right. But that's where she's finding her support. And it's going to be interesting to see. Can I state the very obvious? She's got to win a general election if she wants to keep the job 8 months from now. And we'll see. You can build up a rabid base of supporters for sure on an issue like this. But in a province like Alberta with nearly 5 million people, if you want to win a general election in a place where probably I would say 85 to 90% of people are fully vaccinated and even boosted in most circumstances, I don't know if this strategy plays long term. What do you think?
I mean, I don't think so either, but is this really going to be what's driving folks to the polls 5-6 months from now? Probably not. So as long as she stops, saying this sort of thing closer to the election, she's probably in an okay spot. But this is the kind of thing that I think people aren't going to necessarily forget if she keeps trying to play to that base.
I would imagine a good advisor would tell her that that's probably the last comment on discrimination and vaccination status for at least a while. We want to know what you think about what we're talking about here on the show. You can connect with Supriya and myself on Twitter, on Instagram, and of course you can visit us online at seriouslypod.com.
Yeah, we're on Instagram at seriouslypod, on Twitter at Supriya and Ryan, and you can always email us talk@seriouslypod.com.
We'll chat with you next Wednesday, my friend.
Talk soon.
Seriously is hosted by Supriya Dwivedi and Ryan Jesperson. Technical producer, John Hicks. Executive producer, Josh Dunford. Account coordinator, Lawrence Terlego. General manager, Katie Cook-Shivers. Human resources, Lena Shepherd. Voiceover by me, Tangi. Seriously is a Relay project. For more, check out seriouslypod.com.